Hello, folks. Welcome to episode 41 of the show. Sharad, I call this a show this time. How does it feel?
It feels incredible. I think we're leveling up.
Yeah, we're leveling up. This is very Joe Rogan inspired intro.
Yeah.
So, welcome to all our listeners. This is, as I said, episode 41 of Long Shots, our weekly podcast. This is Nikhil Arora, and I have with me Sharad Tupran.
Yeah, it's good to be here as always, and I can't believe it's been 41 episodes, but we're having a lot of fun this season, and it's different because we have interesting people who are coming in and talking about the kind of work they do. And today is no different because we have a fellow friend and fellow previous classmate to both Nikhil and myself, and Mr. Ashish Khullar, who's currently engaged with the United Nations. He's based out of Boston, but he works closely with the United Nations. Area of expertise, which before he elaborates, I will just give it a brief heads up to our leaders, is listeners, is ecological economics and policy making, and with a political bent towards what the United Nations does. He was elected as a member, or I don't know the technical word, under the age of 30. So let's hear more from Ashish. Ashish, thank you so much for your time. It's a pleasure to have you. And why don't you give us and our listeners a brief overview of how you ended up United Nations and what exactly is that you do?
Maybe we need to talk about the usual house rules, Sharad. Completely forgot it. So firstly, guys, feel free to subscribe to our channel, Long Shots, on Deezer, Spotify, Google Podcasts, so that you get a nice little notification every time an episode goes live. Now, Ashish, to you. Sorry, I'm done with the official bit.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for having me here. And yes, as you rightly alluded to, the United Nations is a complex and at times what seems like an opaque institution and confusing to people who are not associated with the UN. Actually, it's pretty confusing to the people who are associated with the UN as well. So we're all on the same page. But to cut a long story short, the UN does a lot of things. One of the things it does, it brings 193 member states, which are 193 countries, together to discuss, deliberate, and create global legislation in the context of global governance. And it does that through many avenues and on many, many topics related to sustainable development, related to peace and security, related to disarmament, gender, economy, environment. All of these are interrelated. So I'm not getting into the hard distinctions of how the topics are classified. But all, if not most, of the discussions, most, if not all, actually, on sustainable development follow a particular pattern where the discussions take place between the 193 countries and a certain number of non-state actors. And these non-state actors are called the major groups.
Okay.
And these were ascertained in 1992 by the General Assembly itself. So the 193 countries of the UN at that point in time said that we need a new mechanism at the global level to talk about certain issues. And a lot of things were instituted. One of the things that was instituted was an official institutional seat at the negotiation table for non-state actors. Now, these non-state actors at that point in time were women, indigenous people, farmers, young people, science and technology, labor and trade unions, business and industry, NGOs, and I'm getting for one.
That's pretty much everything though, right?
Yeah.
Except the state.
No, so yeah. And since then, it's been expanded to people with disabilities, older people, education and academia. So that's the context in which I have primarily been working. So I occupied one of those seats. And
So which constituency?
For young people, because I was elected under the age of 30. So, by people under the age of 30.
So let's step back a bit in terms of UN obviously is a fairly unique, I would say, career trajectory. It's a very conscious choice that young people take, whether they want to be part of an organization such as the UN. How did that journey start for you?
I mean, I think it's like a lot of other people's journeys in their own career tracks. I mean, you identify something you want to work on, you identify something you want to influence, and you identify the avenue which has the most impact based on what your skill sets and interests are. So, I mean, I've always been interested in and working towards things surrounding the environment. So, you know, ranging from environmental conservation to planting trees to energy efficiency to climate change and also more policy and activism. So in that context, you know, you ask yourself the question, what is the change that you want to see and how is it that you can most maximize your efforts towards that?
So was there like a build-up to this?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's, I don't necessarily say that I specifically work with the UN. I mean, working with the UN is one tangent what I do. So the whole idea is to be involved at every avenue which has the potential to create an impact in what you want to create an impact in. So of course, you know, I started from local work, then I did national work, then I also did global work. But while I'm doing global work, I also do national and local work.
Right.
It's just about where you align more of your capacity based on what your skill set and the need of the hour is at that point in time based on your own perception.
Yeah. And how long have you been doing this?
Well, I mean, I've been associated with the UN in different ways since almost 2009.
Okay. Almost a decade now.
Yeah. Yeah. But specifically in intergovernmental negotiations since 2012.
Okay.
And I mean, now I have a slightly different role. I was an elected, you know, what people would call an elected official. Now I have a role of an advisor and a political appointee.
Interesting. You said elected official. So like, what exactly is the process there? How do you get elected? Who elects you?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So different non-state actors have different means and ways of organizing themselves.
Yeah.
The easiest, I guess, which a lot of your viewers on listeners may associate with is also the business and industry. So the seat of the business and industry is occupied by the International Chamber of Commerce. So how the International Chamber of Commerce is elected is there are accredited businesses, there are business associations that are in accreditation with the UN through a process.
So
of
you have like nationwide industry bodies which kind of become members of the intergovernmental or global industry body.
Yeah. And then they have an election. So this is different for different groups.
So I assume like all the CIs and FICCIs of the world are probably part of the International Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. But a national one can also directly be accredited to the UN. So that's a difference of what we call universal access and federated access, where a national and a local body can have direct access as opposed to only through a federation. But many times they elect the federation to serve that role because it's the easiest for them to do that. So in the context of young people, I mean, there are a lot of organizations, associations of young people, which involves young people in the private sector, young people in...
So this is like your vertical, right?
Yeah.
So like what kind of organizations, like, are there some names that you might know?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, in the context of India, for example, the Indian Council of Youth Organizations.
Okay.
Or if you want to look at other ones, I mean, there are high school and university organizations. Rotaract is...
Oh, yeah, I've heard of Rotaract, yeah.
Something you might know. So, you know, I mean, those are the more popular names, but you also have names that specifically focus on particular topics.
Mm-hmm.
That may work on gender, that may work on climate. Indian Youth Climate Network is one of them.
Yeah.
Which has recognition from the ministry and stuff like that. And then you have World Association of Girl Guides, Girl Scouts, all. I mean, it's a whole range. So there are about 6,000 entities that are credited with the UN in different ways.
So the election process... What level was your entry in this entire value chain of sorts?
Well, I mean, I started as a volunteer, then I rose up the ranks, you know. So, I mean, if you want my specific roles, I mean, I was a member, then... I mean, I was a member through an organization, then I was a volunteer.
Right.
Then I started leading one of the task forces on a particular topic, which was at that point in time, the Green Economy Task Force.
Okay.
Because at that point in time, there was a big global discussion on what people associate as being the green economy. And then beyond that, I became a global focal point for a particular vertical within the constituency. And then after that, I became what is called the organizing partner, which overlooks the whole.
So you couldn't just helicopter in?
I mean, you could if you want, because it's an elected post, but typically it's almost impossible to helicopter. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, it's impossible for an unknown person to go and become the prime minister or something like that. Yeah.
So all these different verticals that you've touched on, right? What is sort of, when I look at your LinkedIn profile and the conversations that we've had offline, sort of you often use the word ecological economics and, you know, you always talk about climate change. Is that an area that is close to you and something, I guess, is something that you work on extensively as well?
Yeah.
So, first of all, what is ecological economics? Like, we come from sort of, you know, we understand Austrian school and classical economics and whatever it is, but can you talk a little bit about what it means and why it's different?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, while my role's been political for the last few years, my substantive background is from the environmental movement.
Okay.
So, that's the connection of the two things here. So, there are different ways people might define ecological economics, and there are people who may belong to the Austrian school of thought but may also identify as ecological economists, and there are people who may belong to the neoclassical, which may also identify. There are Marxists that will identify as ecological economists. So in that context, I'm just highlighting that to understand that ecological economics does not see itself as a vertical, but rather a horizontal,
okay,
which cuts across different schools of thought. So the primary difference between ecological economics and, let's say, all other forms of what we popularly identify as different schools of thoughts is what ecological economists, and, you know, I'm not just ecological economists, but what the other economists also call is the pre-analytical vision.
Okay.
So the pre-analytical vision, essentially, it's when you set the model for analysis. Ecological economics says that the economy is a subset of society and the society is a subset of the environment. A lot of the other schools of thought do not assume that the economy starts at the environment and ends at the environment. It's at the household and the firm. So those are the primary centers of economic policy. And then, of course, the state plays a role depending on what you're talking about. So the materiality assumes that there are infinite resources and infinite capacity to absorb this. Ecological economics says that the first step in an economy is liquidating natural resources,
mm-hmm.
and the last step of the cycle is absorption of waste.
Okay.
So we don't necessarily start at, this is what we are producing at this cost, and this is the relationship with the workers, and this is the relationship with society, and this is the relationship with state. But we start by saying that this is the basic chunk of natural resources that we have,
yeah,
and all economic activity is based on that.
Okay.
And then there are different layers. So when you have a surplus in food production, you have a goods economy. When you have a surplus in the goods sector, you have a services economy, and then so on and so forth. But to keep it really, really simple, ecological economics says that the economy is a subset of the environment and not the other way around.
How does that transpire in terms of from a policy perspective?
Sure. So something I didn't mention intentionally, but I'm going to mention now is environmental economics.
Yeah.
So environmental economics says that, yes, the environment is important. It's an important externality that we have to cost and take into account. Ecological economics might say that, yes, as an intervention, costing externalities might be appropriate, but you're still not taking into account the fact that there are limited resources and limited absorption capacity. So a very, very basic policy framework, I wouldn't even say a specific intervention, because, you know, the neoclassicals will have a different intervention, Marxists will have a different, and Austrians will have a different. But the basic assumption is the basic framework of any ground rules of intervention is what is called the planetary boundaries. So we assume within a framework where we say that our natural resources and our, so to say, renewable and non-renewable resources, because there's a whole debate on that, are finite. And that needs to be the basis of every single economic analysis and projection. So there are terms thrown around like ecological deficit. So while we talk about the fiscal deficit, we should also talk about the ecological deficit. Now, what is the ecological deficit? It is the amount of natural resources you're using in relation to the rate of regeneration of those natural resources. So then some people might say you should institute specific policies which look at degrowth. So they say the goal and the parameter of the measure of an economy's progress should not be how much growth in GDP is being clocked, because it's an agnostic figure. And in all recorded instances, rise in GDP is directly correlated and causated with a rise in ecological footprints.
And causated.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they say, yeah, you start by putting basic limits, and then you figure out ways to distribute those limits. Now, some people will say, you know, the market should do more, the state should do more, it should be a mix of the two and all of that. All of that's up for discussion. But those are, you know, so I mean, if one is to throw around broad terms, ecological deficit and degrowth are the very, very broad terms. Now, if you want to get into more specifics, you know, you can talk about things like stranded assets, mm-hmm. you can talk about things like disclosure, you can talk about things like actual materiality of availability of resources. You can talk about things like, you know, should the amount of metal in circulation in an economy be regulated, not by our capacity to mine, but by the earth's ability to rebound from.
So basically, that kind of becomes your starting point.
The pre-analytical vision.
That puts like a framework around whatever other discussion that you might have.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
But like, tell me one thing, Ashish. It's very interesting that, I mean, obviously that from the perspective of sheer logic and rationality, that makes a lot of sense. But in how many like countries, like sovereign agencies, geographies, have you seen such a ecologically driven framework being implemented? Or is that right now more of a discourse point that you're trying to bring it to mainstream attention, and that would be a next logical step?
Yeah.
Where are we really there?
Yeah. How's the reception to it, right? I mean, how far are we in sort of incorporating that in basic corporate finance, let's call it?
I mean, it depends who you ask. and depends at what level do people see as having adapted to this framework. The idea that natural resources are limited and that life depends on what we call biodiversity is not a controversial idea at all, you know, unless of course you're a certain think tank funded by a certain group, you know, pushing a certain agenda. So, I mean, that's not a refuted idea at all. I think what a lot of people are uncomfortable with, especially certain governments and the private sector specifically, is the notion of limits to growth. The idea of limits to growth is also not new. I mean, there was a book in the 1970s that came out of the Systems Dynamic Institute from MIT. So this is as mainstream as it gets on the scenarios of growth of economic activity and human impact and its impact on the earth. And in return, the ability to have more economic activity and human activity, because, you know, it's because when the natural resource base starts degrading, your ability to sustain a function also starts diminishing. So the idea is pretty mainstream. The idea is pretty well accepted. There are different kinds of interventions people are aiming towards without using the terms like, there are limits.
But, you know, like in terms of the idea being mainstream, I guess there's a lot of political will which is required to bring that out, right? Because there must be a lot of vested forces which are against that idea for the reasons that you have just pointed out.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting that you obviously mentioned a MIT reference. I recall reading that book, Homo Deus, the Hariri guy. He also talks a lot about it, that how come growth in a unidimensional manner, how can it be the only sustainable endpoint, right?
Yeah.
And
the universe is expanding. I mean, that's what people say, because the universe is expanding so we can keep growing. But, you know, I mean,
it doesn't really work like that. And like that, I think 2 days back, I think it was during that budget discussion. There was a lady who was pointing out about jobs elasticity, that every 8% growth only translates into 1% of jobs. But growth is the high level number that everybody is obsessed with.
Yeah.
And we just went through the budget, right? Yeah. We saw fiscal deficit of 3.4% being thrown 20 times, but nobody was talking about ecological deficit.
Yeah.
So I guess the political will is lacking, especially in this part of the world. I mean, I don't think this is part of the narrative here.
It's spread across industries, right? I mean, we come from capital markets background. I mean, the top thing that they chase for is year-over-year growth. Like, growth is as important as it gets. Stocks move on that. He talked about, I mean, the entire debate leading up in the last 1 week, little discussion was, what is the GDP growth rate? Or is it being calculated correctly? It's all growth. Indian, we do a lot of investor bashing sometimes. Nikhil and I on the podcast, we talk about the Indian VC space, and they chase growth as well. Mm-hmm. Sustainability comes second, I feel. It's more like top-line growth, right? So growth is just embedded in everyone's mindsets, right? So to what Nikhil was sort of saying, how do you sort of address that, and at what level? Does it come top down? Does it go bottom up from schools, or does it come from firms? Like, and what is the, you know, political narrative there?
So political will is an interesting concept. There is, of course, one variable is what you see in public discourse. Another variable is what you see in populist messaging. Another variable is what governments seek to commit. A really interesting variable is also what political parties across the spectrum choose to depoliticize and have it not be a political issue. So, I mean, I'll just give you an example. I mean, in India, for, you know, HIV and AIDS was a largely non-political issue compared to a lot of other countries, you know, and not many people know this, but during a lot of important global meetings and conferences that set the trajectory of what the global response for HIV and AIDS should be, the Prime Minister was Vajpayee, and India's representative was Sonia Gandhi.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, but again, was it a political buy-in? I mean, was it in popular discourse? So, I mean, I just went on a tangent to give.
No, it's a great tangent. You like these tangents.
A local context, but, you know, I mean, would you be surprised if I say that 193 countries, which is, you know, every single country that's in the UN, have unanimously decided to move beyond GDP as a primary measure of progress? Now, this is in writing. This is in international soft law. People are expected to report what their national level steps are to achieve these things. You know, so for example, that's one way to look at it. Is the government chasing growth because, you know, it identifies with a certain populist message,
right?
Because in the public's imagination, it translates to something or not is this question. I mean, New Zealand has declared that they're going to move officially beyond GDP. I mean, a lot of countries are already doing this.
Okay.
And even India reports data on beyond GDP. So, yes, political will is a very, very important topic. How political will is calculated how political will is observed is a little more complex. But there is, while there is unanimous acceptance of the notion of the importance of a different economic paradigm, while there is universal acceptance of the notion that unidimensional growth cannot be sustainable or possible, there is also universal apprehension against using terms like boundaries, against using terms like degrowth, because of the political messaging associated with it. So then the question becomes, what are the entry points to try and enhance these kinds of things? I mean, I can list a few, you know, I mean, there's the Global Benchmarking Alliance, which is the largest investors in the world. I mean, you know, Aviva originally championed the effort. Then you have the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. I mean, again, they're all talking about these things. So, you know, we can keep having a discussion on, yes, what do you do to build more political will? What are the markers of political will? And is governmental political will the only variable for something like this?
No, but I mean, in terms of the point that you made, it's very interesting because I think you was kind of saying that there is obviously a commitment at an intergovernmental level, but there is a kind of a differential versus the internal political messaging that is done at the domestic level. But is that the understanding that you are trying to bring about? Or are you trying to say that, because there are two things, there are two versions of it, which I kind of you know, get in my mind. One is that there's a lot of lip service that happens there, and the communication there is completely different. Yeah. And the other is that, no, there's no lip service, there's actual commitment which has been presented on paper.
Yeah.
But yeah, from a messaging perspective, a different approach has been taken. So what do you think is probably the case here?
No, I mean, that's true. I mean, I think that's absolutely true. And it's also what messaging for what people. I mean, people in rural villages are not looking at GDP numbers while they're going to vote. You know, so it's about, I mean, I'll give you an example. In the US, there's so much talk on jobs, right? I mean, for whatever reason, it's a huge political discourse. But I mean, there are more jobs in wind and solar in the US than in all fossil fuels combined.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
the
official congressional study in partnership with somebody else also said, for example, the Keystone XL will not produce more than 50 jobs, right? I mean, so it's about who you're trying to please in what context. And now even climate change has become a huge political discourse. So yes, there is an element of I think the easier bit is...
So the messaging part, I think you agree that there is a lot of messaging that goes on, right?
Yeah.
Depending on the constituency that you are
Absolutely,
doing.
Absolutely. I think that is an easier dichotomy to address and to digest. The harder dichotomy to digest is that without getting into specifics of political parties and political sides, I mean, and I wouldn't say for better or for worse, but for worse, there is a private capture of the political processes in a lot of countries in terms of how elections are financed, in terms of how political parties are financed. I mean, even in a country like India, I mean, NGOs, for example, are expected to disclose everything that they get in terms of foreign funds, and they're subject to audits and even criminal investigations, whereas political parties can have anonymous, unlimited foreign donations, right? So the harder dichotomy is to please the sources of this financing and this capital. And if that is in contradiction with the global agenda or what the global commitments are, that is much harder to move beyond. And there is much less political discourse around that.
But the global commitments are real.
Yeah, the global commitments are real. And that's public information.
In terms of because it's a different thing to disclose a number. But it's a very different thing to actually use that number to steer policy.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so to what extent do you think the global commitment stands? I mean, I know we're talking about 193 countries. It's very difficult to put them all in one bucket or the other bucket. But okay, we are right now in Delhi. Let's talk about India then.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think India has displayed better than expected commitment towards solar energy and other renewables. You know, and that's also, I mean, that has many, many tangents to it as well. But it has, for example.
Conditions apply.
Yeah. And for better or for worse, I mean, I think for better in many contexts, majority of India's farms are still smallholder farms. So, you know, those institute a certain type of farming activity, which is less ecologically destructive, more ecologically restorative. You know, so, I mean, is there appetite in India for a public discourse, for a government going up and saying that we should stop targeting GDP growth? Probably people like you and newsrooms and your investors may fume, but I think it's going to have less impact on the voter, because the voter is less interested in numbers. They're more interested in, of course, elections are not as simple, but, you know, aapko kya mila? That whole point.
Right.
So, yes, I mean, is India progressive on that front? I think it can be a lot more progressive.
Yeah.
I think India was one of the most regressive parties in the ambition of the Paris Agreement. I mean, if you want to talk about climate change, but it has taken a more progressive domestic stand,
right,
you know, for whatever reason. I mean, I don't want to get into that. I mean, there are specific reasons, but it's a different discussion altogether. But, you know, I'd also like to tie this back to capital markets, because you had mentioned capital markets. So I don't know how closely you follow risk in global capital markets as a discussion. But one of the hottest topics these days is what is called stranded assets. So, you know, I mean, I think it's intuitively understood what stranded asset is. And this is developed out of an analysis of the oil and gas field. So if the world is to meet its 1.5 degrees Celsius target under the Paris Agreement, which all countries have agreed to, and components of it have legal recourse and are legally binding, then depending on which oil company you are, up to 80% of your known reserves cannot be burnt.
Right.
So upon the number is not 80% across the board, but it goes up to that.
Right.
And this is known reserves that are not yet mined, and it does not even take into account expenditure for finding new reserves. And you know, and there's a whole profile on which companies are more exposed to what degree in this and that. And of course, there are different scenarios, and these are scenarios based on, you know, figures and statistics which are intergovernmentally approved. So there's a whole political layer before it anyway. So, you know, so you can imagine that the real picture is actually more grim. So what are investors doing about this, right? I mean, so it depends who you are in the capital markets. And, you know, I'm not sure if this term is appropriate, but, you know, I mean, if you're not a trendsetter, if you're not a
influencer,
narrative setter, influencer, if you're, I don't know if bottom feeder is the appropriate term, but, you know, it's not relevant to you in the capital markets in terms of a discourse, but will it impact your life on a daily basis? Yes, absolutely. So capital markets are very closely looking at this. There are a whole range of scenarios.
Yeah.
A lot of fossil fuel companies have put a lot of money in. Of course, they have proactively halted progress on these things as well. But I mean, they realize that these issues exist as well.
Yeah, that's so, what I mean. But in terms of like, irrespective of influencer or not, like typically with oil and gas companies, I mean, the way they're valued is like you look at how much they're producing, barrels per year or day or whatever it is, right? And then you put like a valuation on proven reserves, P2 and proven and unproven, like, right? You go through that level and the riskiness goes high when you go to like, let's call it like just it's not producing, it's just an explore territory. So in that case, it will reflect, right? I mean, if you call it a stressed asset, stranded asset, then it, like the efficiency of the market still can be seen, right? I mean, it's worth diminishes, correct? So that's sort of in line then.
It does. The question is, you know, the notion of a free market theoretically exists, but does it exist in practicality is a whole different question, right? I mean, you can get into the discourse of what is more efficient, capitalism, communism, socialism, but they're all
What is Ashish? What do you think?
No, but I mean, they're still all frameworks that only look at the materiality of goods and the value of services and how they're distributed and what cost.
Sure.
They still don't look at the larger picture in that context. And I mean, if from a pure theoretical perspective, there is very little difference between all three when you start building a framework. I mean, one of the primary assumptions of a perfect market is perfect information and prices.
Yeah.
And in today's market, the only way you make a profit above your competitor is information arbitrage. You know, so I mean, yes, it does reflect in the value.
Yeah.
But are there interests keeping it from being reflected in the value? Yes, absolutely. I mean, are there interests that may not be equally strong that want it to reflect in the value? Yes, absolutely as well. And, you know, and that side of the argument is growing. I mean, you have more and more financial institutions and investors and pension funds and the whole spectrum of factors. I mean, I wouldn't even say jumping onto the bandwagon, but
yeah,
joining the coalition of the willing and saying that, you know, I mean, enough is enough. I mean, now, for example, I think a few years ago, people in, and, you know, I mean, you can quote me on this if you want, because it's all informal discourse, but I mean, it's pretty well known that SBI has, say back, you know, SBI in India, has informally said that the last coal plant to be funded by SBI has already been funded. So we are not going to, of course, I mean, this is not their official figure, but I mean, this has been doing the rounds for a long time. You know, so,
but I mean, like,
so you see that.
It's interesting that you mentioned coal. Obviously, I think in the Indian context, that's a pretty central energy lever, right? And in terms of its stickiness and how it kind of affects the realities of a lot of people here. it's a contentious topic, right?
Yeah.
So, and I guess that kind of also falls on the gray line of being ecologically favorable or not. So, but I mean, that I sometimes feel that, you know, when it comes to such multilateral efforts, right? Obviously, when it comes to, you know, those annual sessions, which get a lot of mainstream eyeballs, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
But as, you know, it's kind of percolates from one layer to another layer, all the way to the ground level, something gets lost in translation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Is there anything that, like, the multilateral organization to start with can do to ensure that, I mean, I'm sure that's like probably your daily existential discussion that you must be having, right? What is the, what exactly is the take there?
No, absolutely. So it's quite ironic that the global multilateral structure and the primary framework for global governance is based on the state being the primary sovereign actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the same system also realizes that the state being the sovereign actor is not a framework that is equipped or appropriate enough to tackle the challenges that we face today. And this is not limited just to the environment or climate change. I mean, this extends to a lot of the modern day issues that we face. I mean, from health to education to gender to bigotry. I mean, you know, everything.
Yeah.
So there is, and, you know, and this realization is not empty. So all efforts at the multilateral level are predominantly focused on how the mechanics of these things are going to work. So Kyoto Protocol, I mean, was the precursor to all of this, which in a very basic sense, what it means is that if you put in place infrastructure that will emit less carbon than the business's usual infrastructure, you will be compensated for spending more money. Yeah. So, I mean, there's one framework. Then you have things like RED and RED Plus, which is reduced emissions by preventing degradation and deforestation, you know. So, I mean, there are a few, but that essentially translates to, we will pay you money to not chop down the forest. Yeah. But the question is, who's going to pay? So the discussion is, in the climate and environmental discourse, the discussion is quite clear as far. So certain countries say that, oh, we are poor, we didn't cause the crisis. And India is in that club. And I call it a club intentionally. It's a club who parade themselves as the protectors of the poor, but only in some context they are.
Yeah.
Say that we are not going to pay for this. The rich countries should pay for this.
Okay.
And China is in the club of the poor as well.
So, yeah.
And then countries like the US and France and Germany say, dude, that was like 1972.
Mm-hmm.
We are in 1972, 1992. Mm-hmm. Now it's almost 2020. Mm-hmm. The world has changed. And the way we respond to these things also needs to change. So,
but I guess there's a lot of historical baggage.
Sure.
That's how these clubs become clubs in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, there is absolutely historical baggage. But I'm just saying that's where the discourse is. It is unimaginable from any stress, from any model, from any scenario that you can tackle global climate change without India and China trying to reduce emissions. I mean, it's just, it is absurd. It is a delusion. And even these countries know that. But internationally, they have another point to prove. I mean, there's a whole layer of politics, yeah? So then you can ask, yeah? Now that we've said that the framework where the sovereign is the primary actor is not appropriate, yeah? So then you need to get into national and subnational dynamics as well. So does India as a whole consume more resources per capita than the earth can supply? No. Yeah. I mean, India at a per capita level. But do the top 100 million, 150, 200 million people in India consume more than the earth can supply? Yes, absolutely. I mean, they're no different from the top 100 million people
in the US.
Yeah.
So, actually, we keep on saying that internally also, that how the parallels between top 100, 200 million Indians and Western society at large. But please, sorry, carry on.
Yeah. So, and why I call it the club is because these 100 million Indians are free riding on the back of the other 1.3 billion. So, which is something that needs to be addressed urgently if somebody needs to be genuine and honest towards the framework that they seek to change or the framework that they seek to function within. So a country like India cannot say, oh yes, the world has changed. Oh yes, there's historical baggage. But then also not apply that to itself internally. So will we get there? I mean, I don't want to give an...
You can paint a cynical picture.
A view on, is human civilization going to limit itself to a 1.5 degree rise? I mean, I personally don't think that's possible given the current trajectory. I don't think anybody thinks that's possible given the current trajectory. There are scenarios under which that can be achieved, and those scenarios are pretty well laid out. And India has to be a big player in that scenario. And those that watch the capital markets closely, there is a lot of money to be made in shaping that transition. Does that mean that our lives are going to fundamentally change? Maybe in some ways they are. Maybe we'll you know, not own as many cars or not own as many things, not have as many big houses, but, you know, is, I don't know if, I mean, of course, I think that's an appropriate price to pay, but I don't even know how we've gotten to this point, but because you want
but
to
I mean, isn't that, I mean, I mean, at the end of the day, isn't inertia one of the biggest failings of human psyche in general, right? I mean, till S really hits the fan, nobody really pays attention.
You probably would argue that S has already hit the fan.
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing is that S has not hit the fan of someone sitting in maybe Delhi.
Yeah.
S has probably hit the fan of, you know, for someone who is along a coastal area or lives on an island or is not from that strata of society, right? And unfortunately, that poor guy doesn't have the... have that voice.
Yeah. So something that's quite interesting within the field of environmental conservation, environmental degradation, biodiversity and climate change is what is called the psychology of these matters. And they say that, you know, it is much easier to rally the world around HIV and AIDS and tuberculosis because it's in front of you.
Yeah.
It's much harder to rally somebody around a future prospect of the unknown where, you know, I mean, because it's a frog sitting in a wall. In a pot where the water is slowly heated. The difference is that there are many frogs and, you know, I mean, it's heated from a different point in different ways. So does most of the world or does most of India live in a context of what may be called chaos or breakdown? I mean, I'd argue yes. I mean, if you don't have access to a medical facility or many Indians, I just don't know, you know, this is a big election issue as well. Toilets don't have access to running water. They're already living in a state of what you would call a financial crisis. It's only when the mainstream or the ones, you know, what you would call the global English-speaking club, when it hits them, suddenly it becomes, I mean, 2000 it became a crisis because it affected people like us and a lot will live like that in general. So, I mean, that's a tangent. But shit hitting the fan. And who is the one to realize that shit hits the fan? And who is the one to take actions on shit hitting the fan? I mean, I think, you know, frankly speaking, regular people sitting in Delhi that do most of the consumption are irrelevant in terms of political or technical impact on what should be done. So I don't think shit hitting the fan for us while driving our cars and this and that is a relevant variable. I mean, it's well known that the Syrian civil war had huge underpinnings in climate change and drought and the processes that ensued. So, I mean, yeah, shit has, you know, as you say, S has hit the fan. The question is what governments and what authorities need to or want to respond to it. And, you know, in terms of the financial sector, yes, the capital markets, the insurers, the bond watchers, they are the ones that are more invested in the longer term picture. So, you know, I mean, they are taking steps.
One kind of sliver of optimism I have here is at least that the basic fact that climate change is happening, I think that constituency here is probably more stable than in the West. What do you think about that? I mean, at least people get it that this is a problem, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a globally stable concern and globally stable constituency.
You think it's all fringe?
It's some in the US that want to, you know, put, I mean, even in India, I mean, executive heads of government have gone and said that the climate is not changing, we are changing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this came from the Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
And but then also acknowledges on the climate change. But, you know, again, I want to press on what you identify as variables and markers of political discourse. So when the US actually signed the Kyoto Protocol,
mm-hmm.
and then the administration following Clinton's administration unsigned the Kyoto Protocol, many cities and states in the US put Kyoto Protocol into effect anyway. So, you know,
because they saw the point of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, you know, but is populism dangerous to impact policy? Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is a dangerous threat, but I don't think the notion that climate change is not real is, I mean, some would say is a major political concern, but I mean, I would say it's generally settled. And those
accepted
that, and those that need to know, those that call the shots and they're across all industries and all sectors, a lot of them are invisible, know, and they're acting on it. And the question is, are they acting fast enough? And what scenario are they acting under? Are they acting under a scenario where 8 billion people will live in distress and 2 billion will live a life of luxury?
Hmm.
You know, like you've seen a lot of dystopian movies.
Yeah.
Or are they acting in a scenario that will create this, what a lot of people call a global flourishing? I mean, that is to be determined. And that is where the larger constituency comes into the picture. And that is where those voices also need to be heard.
Right.
So, you know, who is deciding this? I mean, who is deciding the discount rate on what should be the risk exposure if your balance sheet has so many barrels of known reserves that are untapped?
Right.
Who should decide that risk factor? Should it be a community, vast public-led process? Should it be a private enterprise doing that? Should it be a specific investment house doing that that has already aligned its investments in a particular trajectory? I mean, I think that's where the discourse is currently. And it can only become better by continuously expanding the size of the room, bringing in more and more competing interests into the...
But to be fair, like, I mean, in I think a lot of these, like, for instance, like, interesting thing that you mentioned, that when it came to the Kyoto Protocol, a lot of the guys continued to execute its
provisions
because they kind of felt that it makes sense for them, right? But that by nature requires some amount of decentralization, that there are actually individual or granular decision makers sitting out there. But sometimes I feel like within the domestic, I would say, scenario, centralization is going up, statism is going up, like the government is trying to call more and more of the shots. Whereas I often feel that as soon as, you know, even the most capitalist people, as soon as they see some sort of a commercial endpoint, they align.
Yeah.
Right. Do you think that's a problem, especially in the domestic scenario?
I mean, you're getting into the fundamental questions of governance. You know, I mean, these are not new questions. I mean, these questions have existed since humans decided to organize themselves in different ways. Is federalism good? Yes, absolutely. Is strong central government good? Absolutely. Is a strong global government needed for some issues? Yes, absolutely. So the question is not, is one good or the other? And I don't think you've framed it that way, but you need strong governance right from the global to the local levels. In many contexts...
But I guess it's a factor of domain then.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But what is my... jurisdiction, what is the other person's...
Absolutely, absolutely. I think certain issues should not ever be local issues. I think certain issues should only be local issues.
Yeah.
In many instances, you have seen that the subnational governments are more progressive, but in many instances, subnational governments are less progressive. In many instances, national governments are more progressive, but there is no global government, but the global governance architecture is the other way around. So, you know, you have these parallel forces that exist in all cases, but I think it's a settled fact, or should be a settled fact, that the global environmental commons are a global commons. It's a global issue. Now, it's controversial, but many people may say that the Brazilian Amazon doesn't belong to Brazil, it belongs to the world.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm. The ozone layer belongs to the world. It doesn't belong to any one particular country. Yeah, certain rivers can belong to certain countries, and even within certain countries, certain states, and, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. This road belongs to Delhi and not all of that. And yes, the central government or Delhi government, that's a separate issue. So those discourses can take place. But as far as, you know, certain issues are concerned, it is a global response. And the only way it can happen is global. And yes, but if the global and the sovereign governments are not, if the global framework and the sovereign governments are not delivering, then other people are going to pick up the slack, which has been happening in many instances. And it's also the reverse in many cases, well, mostly in social issues. So in social issues, you have, in the LGBT issue, I mean, at least in the States or in India. In India, the governments decided not to make it a political issue, right? They decided to go the court route. Yeah. Of course, it was a political issue in 2000, previous election. But they decided not to make it a political issue and to let it move forward. You can debate, the courts did it, but it's hard to imagine that something moved to the Supreme Court at such a high level with the Chief Justice on the bench without having a certain buy-in from all political parties. So, it's like when one part of your body is not functioning, the other has to overwork. But in an ideal scenario, all have to function. But it's very, very clear. The response to the global environmental crisis, of which climate change is the biggest chunk, is a global response.
Mm-hmm.
The response to the global issue of HIV and AIDS, the issue of global pandemics. I mean, trade is a global issue. I mean, do only sovereign countries are not the primary actors? I mean, you have special economic zones, you have cities doing their own deals with people, you have some things happening at a firm level. So it's no different. I mean, this issue is no different from how it percolates at the different levels. I mean, I personally hope that there is more global and sovereign level buying. It exists in some places, it doesn't in others.
So UN is sort of the proxy for global governance, right? I mean, that's the ultimate goal, correct? I mean, that's the job. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the mandate of the UN is. But the difference between the UN and a sovereign government, I mean, there are many differences, but the primary difference is that there's no monopoly of force. You understand what monopoly of force is.
Mm-hmm.
The UN or the international community cannot go into a country
and
tell them what to do. Of course, there are provisions within the UN Charter under which a country's national sovereignty can be breached.
Yeah.
And those are crimes of aggression, crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity and a threat to international peace and security. Many people want to add ecocide to that list, which is mm-hmm. crimes against the environment.
Okay.
Many people...
That will be one big subjective.
Many, yeah. Well, it's a discussion that's already going on. I mean, many people want to add... many people want to make climate change a peace and security issue. It's already become, the Security Council has already started discussing climate change.
Mm. Yeah.
So are we going to see international military force going into certain parts of the world to protect certain natural resources? I think that may happen sooner than you think.
Wow.
And
but for that, Mr. President Trump has to first buy into climate change is real.
No, I mean, that's
a joke. Yeah.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is an extreme picturization of I mean, you don't need to actually physically send military.
I know what you're saying. Yeah, influence, basically.
Yeah, and it's happening and it already happens
in
many ways. The mechanics of how it works at times may not be the most appropriate or the most efficient or the most sound, but that notion exists. I mean, it's not even a discourse. I mean, it exists. It is being implemented. And, you know, a very small thing. I mean, if you want to sell organic produce in the European market, the US market, for them the national Indian certification means nothing almost. They want certification from their agencies. Now suddenly the national sovereignty is breached to certify, you know, food production to satisfy the end consumer. So a lot of these things exist. A lot of these things exist in different ways as well, even in military cooperation.
But like, speaking of notions, like, obviously there's a notion about UN as well, right?
Yeah.
In the global context, in terms of obviously we can decouple UN from sovereigns. But you cannot. It's a kind of a circular argument.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Well, what is your take on that in terms of, like, are there a sufficient number of checks and balances within the UN's framework that it is decoupled from who's funding it or to what level? Or, I mean, that's obviously a work in progress, a moving target all the time. But like, high level, what do you think about that notion?
So, the framework of the UN is set by the framework that was created post-World War II. And, you know, which again, the sovereigns are the center of everything. So, I mean, how the UN is structured, how the UN is supposed to be funded is pretty clear, yeah? It's supposed to be, so the UN has an approved budget. Countries, based on their percentage of GDP, of the global GDP, are meant to contribute that much. Most countries don't do that. So, for example, the US is the largest debtor. Yeah, I mean, it owes the most amount. Although it's the largest funder, but it also owes the most amount because it never actually pays.
Right.
Certain Scandinavian countries pay more than they're supposed to. And then certain countries say that, you know, although we've grown, we've become richer, we want to be a $5 trillion economy, but we still don't want to pay anything.
That was very specific. Such a nice hit.
we still don't want to pay. So, but I mean, having said that, McDonald's has more employees globally than the UN does. The approved budget of the UN is less than the approved budget of the Fire Department of Tokyo and the Fire Department of New York.
Okay.
So it's $5 billion. That's peanuts for what it's supposed to
accomplish.
So is the UN the most appropriate framework to come and have a discussion? I think it's the most appropriate from everything that exists. Can it be more relevant to the ground realities? Yes, absolutely. And for example, my role in the UN system was a testament to the fact they are trying to make those changes. But when you move away from the paradigm where the state is the primary sovereign, you also risk to put in place a system which is actually more regressive.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you put in place a system, for example, you know, and I think even the most capitalist people would identify with this, where private enterprise is the center of global governance, is usually problematic as well.
Yeah.
So it's one of the stakeholders.
Sure.
And it needs to be looked at in that context. So I think that's pretty clear. Do I think the UN is more bureaucratic than it needs to be? I mean, yes, absolutely. Is that the doing of the sovereign, or is it sovereign states, or is that the doing of deep state bureaucrats that serve an interest on their own careers? It's a combination of both. I mean, you know, there's no denying those things. I mean, something that's interesting that happened with the UN is, you know, in the global upsurge of a discourse on gender equality, the UN now is actually, the top leadership of the UN has achieved 50% gender parity. So all top positions in the UN are 50% male, 50% female, and that's going to become even more women. So in the Indian context, that would be that the cabinet is over 50% women. I mean, you know, just see the dichotomy, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think it's as simple as saying that these issues are accepted. It's similarly as simple as saying that we need more of the UN, not less. And when you say we need more of the UN, I think what people really mean is that we need more of global governance. Mm-hmm. And we need more of rules-based global governance. And rules-based global governance where the voices of all constituents is equally represented, where it's not dominated by certain sectors, and not others. And that's not to say that that does not happen in the framework where the sovereign does it, because even sovereigns are partial towards who they listen to and who they don't listen to for a number of reasons and variables. So yeah.
So you're at the right place and doing the right things. We've actually clocked 56 minutes already.
Okay.
So
yeah, no, was that nice enough? Were you expecting a different discussion?
I hope it was nice enough for you. It was great for us.
Yeah, it was a fantastic discussion. I actually found it thoroughly enjoying.
I just want to throw out a few terms so people, I mean, although we didn't discuss them, but people can look at them. So I just want to recap. So please, you know, look at ecological deficit, look at ecological tax reform, look at stranded assets, and look at degrowth. So one is to look at the relevant macroeconomic terms for people that will be listening to this.
Two out of the four, I also looked at it.
Yeah, so that's actually helpful.
Yeah, no, so have a look.
We'll put that in our description as well.
No, Ashish, thanks a lot for finding the time. I think we learned a lot today.
Yeah, it was... I thoroughly enjoyed the discussion.
I like the tangents as well.
Yeah.
I think Ashish has a high potential for controversial tangents, but probably we can take that offline as well.
Yeah.
So no, thank you so much for your time and inputs. It's been great having you. And with that, to all our listeners, do feel free to comment to this particular episode of the podcast. It was slightly different from the last few.
Yeah.
Right?
Because the model is different now. We're starting from the ecology. Yes. Everything else is a subset of that.
Yes. So taking that cue, I think I'm sure that you guys will enjoy it. So do drop in your feedback so that we can make these episodes more and more interesting for you. So with that, this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.